The Guardian.
That is the sound of an icebreaker cutting a channel through the Ross Sea ice in Antarctica. We're hearing it from several kilometres away, though. Can you imagine just how loud that would be up close? In the final episode of our series about ocean noise pollution, Chris Watson is speaking with scientists and artists about raising public awareness of underwater noise and what needs to be done to help remedy the situation. I'm Grey Jackson, and I hope you enjoy the final episode of this Science Weekly series, Oceans of Noise. Of course, if you missed the two previous episodes, you can catch up right now in the Science Weekly feed.
Just getting towards sunset, 4:45, Berwick-upon-Tweed Harbour, and there's this beautiful golden light descending into the west, shining silver across the water on the incoming tide, and the soft rolling surf to the side, casting this haze of spray, just smearing the coastline to the south. But what I'm interested in is the pier here in Berwick, because it's stretching out into that oncoming tide, meaning deep water. So it's a perfect opportunity to get out there, get down the pier and put my hydrophones in the water. I love that aspect of anticipating what I'm going to hear when I go recording. It's one of the reasons I do it. I still get excited about the potential and the possibilities. And the great thing about using hydrophones is you can put yourself in the right place at the right time, like we're doing today. But dropping those hydrophones in, you're really fishing for sound. It's like most wildlife sound recording. You can use your sort of field craft and experience, but the animals and the elements don't always read the script, so there's a lot goes to chance. But I really like that, because even if I come out and fail, I still learn something. This is why I do a lot of this stuff, this moment. You've got everything set up and the headphones on. To be able to tune into the sounds under the surface is just amazing, remarkable, and I love it. I'm going to throw this in now. What I'm hearing now underwater is that wonderful harmonic swish, that tug of the tidal waters, and all sorts of rich sea sounds of movement embodied in that. I can hear the water dragging the sand and shingle on the bottom, and that sound of the water tearing down the sides of the stonework under the surface. That was this wonderful ebb and flow. I think it's a real musicality to it. Something I could listen to for a long time. And now, in the darkness of the evening, up here on the surface, we're very much living in the same kind of low-level visibility as the sea mammals are all the time. They live in a world of sound and vibrations.
Welcome to the third episode of Oceans of Noise. Going out recording to places like Berwick Pier, I always really enjoy the wonder of tuning into this world below the surface. The places are revealed to me as sonically rich, dense environments. And listening to these complex recordings, which are full of sound and noise, it seems hard to imagine what it would be like if these habitats suddenly fell silent.
I'm Tim Gordon. I'm a marine biologist working at the University of Exeter and at the Australian Institute of Marine Science. I work on coral reefs primarily, trying to understand how we can learn more about coral reefs by listening to them. I grew up, brought up on a diet of David Attenborough documentaries and, you know, nature posters up on the wall and things. And I had in mind that the Great Barrier Reef was this kaleidoscope of colour and this symphony of sound and this complete bustle of life, you know, underwater city of the sea type thing. And I was all set to go there and do a research project on the bioacoustics of this wonderfully diverse, incredible ecosystem. It's a long journey. Going to the Barrier Reef takes a while. We'd get all our equipment together, dive medical gear checked, and then we get on a little six-seater aeroplane out to a place called Lizard Island, which is way out in the remote northern reaches of the Barrier Reef. You can see the reef as you fly over. The coral formations appear dark compared to the white of the light sand below, and occasionally you can see sharks and big fish going between the corals as you fly over. Touch down on this tiny lump of rock in the middle of the sea. It's a really exciting experience. And then, of course, you can get off the plane and rummage around your bag for your snorkel, and the first thing you do is jump in the sea and go and have a look. The sun was just starting to set as we were swimming around, and what I was met with was not what I was used to seeing on TV and what I had posters up on my bedroom wall growing up, but was this dying rubble field. It was really heartbreaking. The place that you have been so inspired by and the place that you have been so looking forward to understanding more of and marvelling at and studying in more depth has changed beyond all recognition. On a healthy reef, the sound is really overwhelming. First thing that hits you is this sort of crackle of shrimp noise that's all over the place. It's kind of like frying bacon, you know, that's going on everywhere. And then that's punctuated by the sounds of fish, and they range from sort of low frequency popping or grunting sounds. Sometimes there's a slightly higher pitch sort of whooping and chirping sounds. There's like quite percussive chatters some of the time. And then occasionally there's noises you just don't know what they are. And you hear them and you think, goodness me, what on earth was that? And nobody knows some of the time. That's the beauty of it. Bleached reefs sound very different. They sound eerie, is probably the best way of putting it, because you dive down below the waves, you are still, you hold your breath, you clear your ears, and where you would expect to hear all that noise going on around you, you just hear emptiness. There's still some aspects of it there. You hear a bit of a crackle, it's much quieter. You probably don't hear nearly as many fish. You don't hear nearly as much sort of diversity of sound and activity. And sometimes you notice the things that you can't usually hear, the sounds of things on the shore that would usually be drowned out by all of this life around you, but in the emptiness, they now come through. And that's, for me, quite a haunting reminder of what's no longer there. I went to the Barrier Reef, knowing that it was the biggest living organism on the planet, and it's this astonishing example of an incredibly diverse system, but it had been through this massive degradation in the last year before I'd got there. And this was a place that had been really severely damaged. For me, yes, it's heartbreaking to hear that the sound of the reef has changed, but it's actually a really important functional role in the ecosystem as well. So as well as being heartbreaking as a symptom, it's terrifying as a prediction of what is going to happen next. Because many, many organisms, fish, invertebrates, even corals, have a larval planktonic stage. That means at the start of their life, the larvae of the animals are swept out into the open ocean. And then they grow up in the open ocean, and then they come back as adults to the reef to start their adult life. That journey back to the reef, They do that using sound, amongst other mechanisms, but a large part of the way that they find their way home is that they can hear reefs, because sound travels really well. They hear the reef sound from a distance away, and then they're able to use that as a cue to navigate towards reefs, and also as a cue to settle on reefs, so also as a sort of decision-making prompt. I can hear that I'm on a healthy reef, now I'm going to settle. So we've done a range of experiments on a range of different animals that show that when they hear this sound, they navigate towards it, and they use that sound as a cue to start their life on the reef. If the reef sound changes, then that behavioural mechanism may well break down, and we're starting to see evidence that that will be the case, and that these animals that used to come and feed the next generation of the reef, grow up to be the next animals on the reef that are so central to its functioning, graze away the algae that form associations with each other, create the whole fabric of the community. If they're not being replaced by this larval replenishment each year, then the populations are going to crash. And if there's no healthy sound to draw them in, I would really worry that the future of the reef is jeopardized by its silence today.
So far in this series, we've heard stories about the impact of shipping and seismic testing on ocean acoustics. In the bleaching and silencing of coral reefs in Tim's story, we heard how climate change itself is silencing entire marine habitats. I think one of the reasons people such as Tim Gordon and myself care so much about these ocean environments is that we've had the privilege to travel to these places and really immerse our ears into these worlds. In doing so, we've witnessed the first-hand changes. But for people without that direct connection to these worlds, the urgency of protecting these soundscapes might not be so apparent. And noise pollution remains a far less well-known problem than the other ocean environmental issues. This is where people like my friend Marcus Raymond can come in.
Marcus, man, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
How have you been?
Great.
Yeah.
You look great.
Yeah. And you, like your beard.
That's what happens on a boat.
So, Marcus, what I have to do first of all is declare an interest, because I've had the pleasure and privilege of working on board the Dardanella on two occasions with yourself off the coast of Iceland and off the coast of the Dominican Republic. But for everybody else, for the purpose of this podcast, tell me about the Dardanella and the Academy.
Chris, it is an absolute pleasure to be with you again. As you said, we've spent time on the Dardanella. The Dardanella is a 39-meter explorer vessel. And it has all kinds of sound recording equipment. It has a sophisticated playback system to listen to the field recordings that you've just done, which is very helpful. And there's a complete dive outfit. So it really is equipped for immersive oceanic experiences. The Dardanella is the main content provider of the organization that I run, which is TBA 21 Academy. The Academy bring on board teams of artists, scientists, environmentalists, lawyers, very often indigenous leadership. We try to bring these very diverse groups of people together to go on these expeditions, to sense the ocean in a very different way, to allow a number of entry points and provide a number of vantage points in understanding and provide a platform for this collaboration.
And I really like that cross-pollination of ideas and exchanges between the artistic community, the engineering people on the ship, and the scientific blend of all those things. Mm. I thought was really rewarding. And I imagine that's only got better as the Academy's progressed.
Yeah, it has. I think recording is an intense engagement with your environment, right? It becomes such an intense meditative engagement that you've built such a strong connection that opens this other dimension of focus. We very often work with scientists that are specialists in their field, absolute, you know, on the top of their game, working on and with the ocean, but never go to sea, right? They sit in their office, they sit behind a screen, they work with climate models, they work with figures. Right, but then you have these moments where you sit inside of the boat and the hull of the boat sings the song of the whale. That's a moment. All of a sudden, you understand. you understand that that we need to change drastically, right? Otherwise these these exploitative habits that we have are just they're insane. When you're out there in an environment like that, then you just understand that it's insane, and then you understand that we have to radically change our behavior and our imagination of the future, how we want to live with this planet, on this planet, as a species amongst each other, but also with other species. That I believe the only space to imagine this in is the art space. But then the question is, how do you act upon this imagination?
That's a good point, because I got that when we were on board, because of course sound recording in that sense is a solitary activity. Mm-hmm. Once you put headphones on, you're in a world which is unique, and you get this deeply personal, intense experience because you're focused, eyes closed, and listening, trying to pick up that very distant blue whale three-note call as it dives. But the great thing about going on board the Dardanella was, with a sound system, being able to play back those recordings and then starting an exchange, which for me at the time was unique, between artists, scientists, and contributors, just starting a conversation. Mm-hmm. So it's a great learning experience as well.
Yeah, the scientists become part of the process, where there's work, there's recording, there's analysis, there's synthesis. Then also the other thing that became clear when we played some of the recordings to scientists, and they were blown away by the aesthetic dimension, because all of a sudden, wow, this is what the chorus of the coral reef sounds like. This is the multitude of voices that I can very clearly hear where they are situated. Is this a call and response? What is this? How does the volume of the reef actually talk about the health of the reef? All of these things that all of a sudden open up because there is an aesthetic ambition of an artist, right, that goes out with a certain mindset. All of a sudden, to have this kind of exposure of a scientist to the work that is based on field recordings open up a door.
This is a recording of humpback whales in the distance approaching the Silverbank, a large area of coral off the coast of the Dominican Republic, which I recorded whilst on board the Dardanella. Many of the advocates for protecting the ocean that we've heard from in this series have been reactive. For example, discovering that an activity already taking place in the ocean, like shipping, is causing noise pollution. But Marcus and his team's latest challenge is preventing what may be a devastating new form of future noise pollution, deep sea mining.
Having started to look into conservation and understanding that you're always running behind the catastrophe, trying to fix something, right? This was something where we realized this is an environmental disaster waiting to happen. We heard about a United Nations body, or it's a tool for the United Nations, called the International Seabed Authority, a rather obscure organization that is tasked with administration and distribution of the resources on the seabed in the high seas.
So in international waters?
International waters. And they give licenses for exploration. Currently, they're only exploration, but then it goes into exploitation for the mining of the seabed. Currently, it's still in a state of not being exploited, right? Because we haven't found a mining code yet. So there's no agreement amongst the member states on the environmental impact of deep sea mining. But once this is found and they're pushing to find this, this is going to be an ongoing disturbance, right? These are ongoing source of noise.
So how optimistic are you now with the work the Academy is doing to, I mean, not only to bring people's attention to this, but bringing people together to consider solutions or changes at least?
I guess this is a daily changing answer. But being maybe a naively romantic hippie, right? I'm very positive. I'm very positive because this is a do or die situation. But I think the challenge that we're facing is one that is so big, we can only attempt to deal with it, to grapple with it and move forward if we do it together. And that's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
In working with the International Seabed Authority, Marcus and his team are trying to form strong connections between the people who set the rules governing how we treat the ocean and the survival of that underwater environment. Using the sounds of the ocean to create a bond and a greater empathy with marine life. This is important because if we're going to protect the future of marine acoustic environments, there's a need for an international consensus on that protection. The ocean's continued health is vital to us all. Nicholas Entrop works for an organisation whose work is also focused on building an international consensus on the protection of marine wildlife.
I'm an ocean policy expert. Well, I think so at least. And I work for the non-governmental organisation Ocean Care, which is based in Switzerland. I'm Austrian. So an Austrian working for a Swiss organisation trying to protect the sea is quite a statement. Sound does play an extraordinary important role beyond the surface. And, you know, animals communicate, animals orientate with sound, but they can't speak out. You know, we don't hear them, what their interests are. So Ocean Care is giving them a voice in the area where decisions are made and also to those who are impacting on the life of the marine species. I think the first time I was exposed to the question of what the impact noise is causing on marine life was in the early 2000s when a mass stranding of whales appeared in the Bahamas. And at the time, there was a whale researcher out there who raised the question, what have caused it? And the only rational answer that was out there was that at the same time the stranding happened, military activities were taking place, in particular what was called a system called low-frequency or mid-frequency active sonar, which was employed to find foreign submarines. And since then, organizations like Ocean Care and the Whale and Dolphin Conservation and others have looked at the issue and taken it from there and took the issue then to the United Nations and said, look, we need to really address that particular threat out there. And this is how it started. In the early 21st century, it was predominantly looked from a perspective of the impact on whales and dolphins. But today, 15 years or almost 20 years later, we know that noise is impacting on basically all life in the ocean. And that's much, much more of concern than we even have imagined back then 20 years ago. 2 years ago, the Ocean Care commissioned a scientist, Linda Weilgaard, to review all the scientific papers out there discussing and addressing the impacts of ocean noise on fish and invertebrates. And when she came back with a draft and I reviewed it, I was thinking like I'm reading a thriller. It was about more than 120 papers she reviewed, and it's like, oh God, what is happening? And at the time when she provided the draft, it was the same time when suddenly an Australian university released new findings about the impacts of one single air gun on krill, on zooplankton. Krill zooplankton is one of the fundamental part of the marine food chain. And basically the results were that within a radiation of 1.2 kilometers from a third of the species of the major krill, the biomass was reduced by 95%. So the researchers themselves came back and said, hey people, we do have a problem. And probably that problem is much bigger than we ever thought of. A huge problem, which probably has a socioeconomic impact on fisheries, on food security. So let's take this seriously. Today we understand that in particular, intense noise, but also the constant increase of drowning from noise sources does impact on all marine life. So the knowledge about impacts is increasing. However, we shouldn't fall the trap about one thing. Science is always raising questions. And yes, you know, it's a very complex field and there are still questions to be answered. But asking questions does not prevent us to take action to mitigate those threats.
With increased emphasis in the last 15 years on studying the effects of oceanic noise pollution, there's now a critical mass of evidence Those like Nicholas Entrop of OceanCare are using this body of scientific knowledge on the impact of ocean noise pollution to highlight the urgency of the issue and the need for action.
Yeah, OceanCare was involved in a study creating a noise map for the Mediterranean Sea. This report detected, when it comes to seismic surveys, that in the year 2005, the seismic activities covered a range of up to 4% of the Mediterranean Sea surface. And 8 years later, it covered around 27%. So there has been an extraordinary, significant increase in the scope of seismic activities. And what we are concerned about is that until today, there is no transparent overview where seismic activities and when are seismic activities taking place. It's just the knowledge by the national governments. And even if they release it on the websites, there is no common understanding where those activities take place. And that's a huge, huge gap and a huge mistake and failure by governments, but also, of course, by international movement to address the issue. The United Nations do have certain conventions in place that try to protect the marine biodiversity or marine species. So the ambition is there, but the question comes, why do we believe it fails? And it fails because most of those instruments lack enforcement tools, and enforcement is always with the national government itself. And here comes the big problem, and we see the same situation with the European Union. We have one of the most ambitious conservation legislation in place within the European Union. For example, the Habitats Directive, it protects a vast number of marine species. It protects them from harassment, it protects them to be harmed. So basically, you have a clear legislative objective to protect species from negative impacts of noise. And 10 years ago, the governments of the European Union decided upon what is called the Marine Strategy Framework Directive. It sounds complicated, but basically it says when it comes to ocean noise, we need to reach a good environmental status. And that means species and the environment shouldn't be harmed by threats such as ocean noise. And when we look then into the practical implementation of measures, which is up again to the national governments, it's outrageous. There is hardly any measure taken, any measure in place to reach those objectives. So the critique we have is, yes, we do have ambitious decisions out there, but we really lack concrete action and compliance. You know, there is now momentum that has been gained. In summer 2018, the United Nations, the Division of the Law of the Sea, organized a week of consultation on the impacts of anthropogenic noise in New York. So they've addressed the issue. They've brought it to the attention of the General Assembly. A decision was made within a resolution that, yes, we have to understand and look into the socioeconomic impacts. So We do gain ground. Yes, it's addressed, but I cannot stress it often enough. We need governments to take action. It's really up to them, and this is where we still fail.
Listening to Nicholas talk about how some countries are failing to act on marine noise pollution can feel dispiriting. At the end of last year, United States regulators announced that they were granting new licenses for seismic testing, which has caused an outcry from scientists in the international media, who say it will cause extreme disruption to aquatic life. But you can also hear his optimism that change on ocean noise can happen. And this optimism for the future of marine habitats is something that's shared by many of the scientists we've talked to in this series.
I think all marine biologists are optimistic. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. You have to be optimistic. But partly I'm optimistic because I have to be, and partly I'm optimistic because in amongst all the tragedy and in amongst all the moments that break your heart, there are moments that really inspire you.
What I should reveal at this point is that my name Asha means hope. So I am a glass half full kind of person, and I'm ever the optimist. And I'm incredibly hopeful, but it is up to us, people like myself, other scientists, other marine conservationists, to engage people to believe that they can be part of that solution.
And this isn't just some blind hope for the future. This hope is translating into solutions. Chris Clark and Asher DeVos.
There is hope, there is promise, and there's actual change happening right now. And it's because industries and the individuals and the corporations and the activities that are responsible for this increase in noise simply didn't realize it. It wasn't necessarily denial. It was just like, I had no idea. It was that kind of expression. So there have been, I cannot count how many meetings at different levels, whether it's with politicians or with banks, often led by, you know, engineers and shipbuilders. We know how to make quiet ships. It's just a matter of making them quiet. So these things are now happening.
Yeah, so the shipping industry has actually been very positive about the research that's come out. I do have to applaud them because it is a big industry. It's, you know, so important to all of us. But some companies have actually voluntarily started moving vessels offshore. So we are seeing this shift.
The same is true in the seismic airgun exploration industry. There's a whole initiative within the industry to develop less noisy, less loud ways of producing a sound that can penetrate into the seafloor. So those are all things that can happen, and we can do it in a smart way that leads to a decrease in our impact on ocean life.
My biggest thing is I always tell people, share the stories. I think that's the most important thing you can do. What you learn today, what you hear today, go tell someone else. Talk about the stories about how noise affects these animals. Talk about how these animals see their worlds. Talk about like what our impacts are and how we are dependent, but we don't have to struggle and think, well, I am a part of the problem and I can't do anything. Believe that you can be part of the solution and look for ways that you can have positive impact.
One of the positive attributes of noise pollution is that when you turn the ship off or you stop setting off explosions, you know, when you turn the volume down, the noise in the ocean goes away. It's not like a chemical insult where it takes decades. So there's an immediate benefit from being quieter and making less noise.
After a day working in my studio, I often come out here to the beach at Blyth on the Northumberland coast. Because I can take a long view, I can rest my eyes on that vanishing point where the North Sea meets the sky and just stand and soak up the ambient sounds of sea wash. And I've come here today really just to reflect on what I've heard throughout this series. Just across the North Sea, Jana Vindra and I experienced at first hand some of the new research into the effects of noise on fish in the North Sea and Western fjords. What was really encouraging from the scientists is that they were suggesting that when man-made noises are reduced or removed, the fish will hopefully return to those areas and behave normally. I'm still delighted and often surprised when I go out recording with my hydrophones, fishing for sound. And both Jana and I agreed that being able to work creatively with our recordings, in collaboration with the scientific community, we can make work that inspires and informs audiences of the challenges and the delights of tuning into the voices, songs, and signals which are out there under the waves.
Oceans of Noise was presented by Chris Watson and produced by David Waters. The executive producers were Catherine Godfrey and Shanida Scotland, with sound engineering by Pascal Wise. The commissioning editor was Tracy McVeigh. And thank you to all the scientists and artists that helped us to make the series. The podcasts are a part of the Guardian Seascape project, examining the health of the seas and the impact of fishing and pollution on our vast oceans. You can find more from that series by searching Seascape over at The Guardian.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.